Howdy and welcome to the River Talk Podcast, hosted by Priscilla Macy, Zach Collier, and me, Eric Weisseth. This week, we're going to talk about the Klamath River and some dams being removed with a good friend of ours, Pete Wallstrom. But before we get to that, we'd like to start off with some news of the week. So, Zach, Priscilla, anything you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question for Priscilla, and this has to do with the new Oregon State Marine Board fees that are going into place. And so I guess I have a couple of questions first. Did that bill pass? Are we definitely be charged fees?
Yeah, Senate Bill 47 has been enrolled and passed. However, the effective date is not until, hold on. It's not till 2020. Okay. August 1st, 2020.
Okay, so next August, we're going to have to pay fees to vote in Oregon beyond the invasive species and aquatic invasive species fees. And it just reminded me, like, if I own, like, two rafts, how much am I going to pay a year?
Well, so if you own two rafts and you only use one of them at a time, it would be you could do $17 for an annual permit, or you could do $30 for a biannual permit, and the permits are transferable. So if you don't use multiple boats at the same time and you're just a non-commercial individual user, you can move that permit from your 10-foot plus boat to another 10-foot plus boat, like even if a friend is using it. It's basically the same rules that they had for the invasive species permit.
Okay, so I'm a kayaker and a rafter. I have a kayak. The kayak doesn't matter because it's shorter than 10 feet. Raft and my cataract, I never use at the same time. It's like one or the other. I'm paying $30 for 2 years, and I can just switch the pass between the boat, whichever one I'm using. Doesn't seem like a huge deal, other than the fact that I'm anti-taxes, so I'm against all taxes. as just because that's who I am. But like as a rational human being, I'm also like, it's not a big deal. It's $30 in 2 years, like whatever. I'm going to get over it. And the money, you don't have to pay this fee if you're on federally managed wild and scenic rivers. So if I'm doing the Deschutes or the Rogue or even like the Sycan, for example, they're federally managed wild and scenic rivers. On those rivers, they won't check me on it because it's federal land. Is that right?
That's correct. And I think the theory behind that is that you're already paying to either get the permit there. There's already federal money going to the management of those areas per the management act the management plan that was enacted when it was designated. So there's already money going towards recreation on those rivers. So it seems
that
redundant.
Was not my understanding was that it was federally managed rivers where you pay a fee, like you pay an entrance fee, like the general public pays a fee, like the Rogue, but like the North Umpqua, even though it's federally navigable or federally managed, still fell under you had to have the permit, was my understanding. But I was also, that was a while back in this process, that could have changed towards the end. But I know at one point, like the Umpqua, I was still going to have it.
A good example too would be the Oahe. Because people,
I brought up Oahe.
Would frustrate me because if I'm from living in Boise and I have to pay $15 or $17 a boat to go run the Oahe, I would, as an Idaho resident, I would be really mad at Oregonians for charging me that fee. But because the Oahe is a federally managed wild and scenic river, you shouldn't have to pay it, but you're also not paying a fee to be on the Oahe. So that's an important point. Are we unsure about the answer this one is?
Priscilla didn't want to answer, so she left.
Yeah. I think I see her things on mute, so she's like, I'm out.
I'm sorry. I was talking. I found it. Okay, I didn't realize I put it on mute. So I did find it. It's in Section 5 of the bill that was enacted. So it says a person operating a boat on a federally designated wild and scenic river for which a separate fee system is in place. So I guess by that language, it's implying that it would be a wild and scenic river where there is a fee system. It might be worth, I might go ask the Marine Board if that just means a designated wild and scenic river where there's permits required, or is it specific to the fee system?
Yeah.
But as I read it here, it means if you are on a wild and scenic river where you have to pay money to be there, you don't need the permit, which so I guess
rogue,
makes sense.
So the rogue's an example.
My conversation with the Marine Board guy, I specifically brought up the Oahe, and he said that, you know, again, this was, I think, in the earlier stages,
mm-hmm.
but the impression of the conversation I had with him was that you would need it on, say, the Oahe.
Because there's no fee system there. It's just
there's no fee system for the general public.
Got it. And that's how I read the language here as well. And I guess that makes sense because the fees for accessing, say, the Rogue go to management of the Rogue.
Yeah.
It leaves it basically it's the Deschutes and the Rogue.
Right.
Where you don't need it.
Yeah.
And as a gun-toting Idahoan, I would be very upset about that, Eric. At us liberal Oregonians taking your money away with taxes.
Yeah, but then you come over to Idaho and use some of the shitty boat ramps that are here, and you quickly gain the appreciation for Marine Board boat ramp money.
We have shitty boat ramps here, too. Come do the
hood. Yeah, you do. Don't get me wrong. Yes, that's true. But at least from a commercial standpoint, I only have one boat ramp in Oregon where I have to carry a raft very far. Mm-hmm. And at the takeout, and here in Idaho, it's just like there's some really bad boat ramps around here, really popular sections of the river.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I think it seems like there's some confusion about how this money can be used in comments and conversations I've seen. Is this money can be used for new access? It can't be used to maintain existing access. And what I think is neat about it is it can be used for acquisitions of property, leases, or easements. So I think in Oregon, especially, that's a really kind of important part of the bill that potentially could benefit a lot of boaters is when there's an opportunity to acquire a property that is adjacent to a waterway versus having it acquired by a private entity that's maybe not pro-access. You know, someone like American Whitewater or State Parks or whoever can apply for this out of this pot of money and say, here's this plot of land on this river that would benefit from more formal access or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically an argument between freedom-loving Americans and communists. And
I don't know about that.
Okay, well, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I feel like I'm hearing both sides of this. I'm going to stay out of it, I guess. But I feel like, Priscilla, you and I have kind of got involved in this discussion with a friend of ours online about this. And I think a lot of people are annoyed that after having to pay. But the benefit is this grant that gets us potential put-ins, which is awesome. And living in Hood River, we have terrible river access. And I would be stoked if there was somebody who could apply for a grant and buy some of this land to give us river access.
On the Hood. Yeah, that would be a perfect opportunity where access improvements would be very beneficial. And I mean, the other part of this is the nuanced politics and working in the Capitol. And one of the things that comes up over and over again when I and others are making asks to further access for paddling or protect access for paddling is, well, what are boaters doing to pay into the pot of money for management? Because you have all these other user groups, you know, anglers, ATV users, hunters, all these people that are paying and have been paying for licenses or permits or access, mm-hmm. aside from site-specific access, and that weighs heavily on legislators. So in terms of priorities, boaters and non-motorized users are very low on the list when making requests to legislators. And so at least for me, this is really beneficial to bring into conversations where I'm saying, hey, we need to keep protecting access to rivers so that we can keep boating them. And a legislator sees, well, what have you done to pay your fair share? I can say, well, you know, a number of boaters worked on this bill and have agreed to pay a fee for access similar to what is in existence for other activities that happen on waterways and lands in the state. And it's amazing how far that goes. It's goes from being a hard stop of you're just kind of freeloading off of other people's fees to, oh, you are actually paying it forward. And whether or not people fundamentally agree with paying taxes or not, I don't think that matters so much as what potential this, the passage of this bill and voters having worked on it has for future waterway access protections.
So that's a great point. And it's great to hear you say that. So thank you for eloquently like passing it on to everybody. We haven't got to my question yet. So Priscilla, my question is, can the BLM apply for funds to the Oregon State Marine Board?
As I read it in the bill, my understanding is yes. It doesn't mean they will be prioritized over other applicants, though.
Okay. Cool. Well, I'm going to try to patch Pete into this call. I know we want to talk to Pete about what's happening on the Klamath River. So let's see if this works. Do one of you guys want to introduce Pete?
Yeah.
Is Eric even there?
Hello.
Here's Pete.
Hey.
Woo-hoo.
Great. So we're bringing in Pete Wallstrom from Momentum Rafting out of Ashland, Oregon. Pete does a number of rivers, the Cal Salmon, the Klamath, the Rogue, the Maine Salmon, the Owyhee, and a bunch of other things commercially. And Pete, being in Ashland and having the Upper Klamath be one of kind of, I would say, your summer keep you busy trips. And the dam removals that have been sort of in the works for like 15 years on the Klamath are going to make a direct impact on that stretch of river, specifically the Upper Klamath. And Pete's neck deep in dealing with what that's going to look like. And so, yeah, we're excited to hear from Pete today. And there you go.
Welcome, Pete.
Hi, you sound like a good host.
Eric is very professional.
I feel the sarcasm.
No, it's really. I'm like, oh God, this is way more than I was expecting.
Got us on a good day.
we have like 15 listeners at this point. It's a very professional show.
So yeah, Pete, we just really wanted to talk about the Klamath. I know there's been kind of some divisive conversations about river access versus restoration outcomes. And I think it's an important conversation that we have, just knowing the history of this project and how integral of a role guides and outfitters have and boaters have been in terms of advocacy for the removal and restoration of the river itself. And now it seems like there are some that would like to see recreation and conservation at a head with each other versus working collaboratively together for the best success story on this, you know, the largest dam removal in the country. So why don't you give us, for our listeners that aren't so familiar with the project, a quick elevator pitch on this project?
Yeah, Pete, I would love to get just like a background thing, you know, like here's kind of what is going on. Here's the big picture of the project. Here's, you know, why we've been really excited about it and sort of where we currently are today.
Yeah. So like you said, this has been going on for a long time, like over 15 years. But basically right now the plan is we're in motion to take out four dams. So there's actually five in that section. And so we're going to be taking out the four lower ones. And the first one is called J.C. Boyle, and it has a small reservoir, but it is the dam that gives us the peaking flows for the kind of the famous Upper Klamath section. And then below that, there is Kopko, which is makes the big reservoir that you float into, and then Iron Gate 1 and Iron Gate 2, which are down below. So that we're trying to remove all four of those dams, which is great for the river. It's it is something that needs to happen. It will definitely affect boating, in this case, particularly commercial boating, because we won't have the Upper Klamath as this, you know, big water summer run anymore. So we'll lose that, which is a bummer. But what we're gaining in the health of the river is more important for sure. There will be other stretches, either that were under the reservoir or were dewatered, that will also offer awesome whitewater and some really good fishing. But as we're saying, we need access to those stretches. And we were working with the company that is tasked with taking the dams out And after a rocky start, they seemed to really warm up and they did some great things. And then they basically came back and said they couldn't do any of the accesses. So that's where we're at now. We're trying to fix that. So
the big issue there is.
And I was going to say, too, what.
Well, just you get for a bit of background there, you know, kind of casually following this project for a long, long, long time. my understanding of it is, and Pete, correct, tell me where I'm wrong, is that, you know, these four dams are spread out over two states. And, you know, so you've got two states that you're dealing with and all the regulations go along with that. But you've got farmers. So you got agriculture, you've got recreation, you have sort of indigenous groups, you know, and all these user groups that are part of this conversation. And, you know, over like 15 years, they've done a lot to mitigate the different user groups, and recreation was a big part of that. And, you know, as river users, you know, everybody I know, even people like yourself who own businesses that, you know, are going to suffer from the Upper Klamath not being watered, we're all really for it because the Klamath needs this, like the fishery needs it, all that kind of stuff. It'd just be really good for the river. But there was, you know, kind of a long fight to gain access to some of these other places that currently don't have roads or access points to them because either they're under the reservoir or they're dewatered, so there's no need. But as the river gets opened up, there's these potentially incredible recreation locations that as this process has gone on, people have advocated for and was kind of built into the plan as things that were going to happen. And now as we get to kind of like, you know, for a sports analogy, and I don't know the sports, but a ninth inning scenario, they're basically backing out, right? Like they're changing the plan and saying like, you know, we're still going to honor all of our commitments to the other people, but recreation, you guys are kind of getting screwed here.
Yeah, that's basically what's going on. I mean, you kind of went way back to the beginning, and there is a lot of groups involved. The farmers aren't actually really affected by this because none of these dams store water. So they've kind of been left, or not left out, but they're not really a huge part of this right now. But the big people are the tribes for sure, and fishing interests and environmental groups. Recreation, to be quite honest, there's been three different main plans to take the dams out, and we're at the third right now. We've basically been left out every single time. I can still remember sitting in a hotel here in Ashland for one of the first meetings to try to figure all this stuff out, and we literally got voted out. So it's definitely been a battle for that part the whole way, until this summer when it seemed like recreation was going to be more a part of it. And it's a big deal. Like I am to be honest, a huge environmentalist. Like it's something I care about. It's the reason I own a rafting company. It's the reason I love taking people outside. I think it's like the biggest thing to, if you show a wide range of people these places, it's more likely that they're going to be protected. And I do, even though I'm a huge part of the environment, I'm very in the environmental community, I do think the community sometimes forgets that. And I think they're kind of got their blinders on sometimes, and they're thinking about short-term gains over long-term gains. And I think that is definitely happening in this case.
Yeah. And Pete, something that you and I talked about a little bit when we all did that tour of the site near Klamath Falls was how, you know, planning for restoration comprehensively in a meaningful way where you're maximizing the resources and capital put into a project by integrating recreation into these conservation projects on the forefront versus what seems to be the easy but short-sighted answer of, well, we'll do it afterwards. Can you go into a little bit about just the cost of that and why it doesn't make sense to trudge forward on just the dam removals, take out all the millions of dollars of equipment down in the canyon while it's dewatered, and then come back at some later date and try to figure out recreation access later on?
Yeah, I mean, from a practical, like you were just saying, from a practical standpoint, when we worked on planning for these river accesses, we really made sure they're in spots that are already impacted, so they'd be pretty easy to put accesses in. And then we have, or there'll be all this equipment used to remove the dams already there, just ready, you know, to put an access to the river and put some gravel down, you know, which is basically what we need and toilets sometimes. So from that part, it's just kind of a no-brainer. I mean, it's so much less expensive than to come back in later. And then the other huge cost thing is, I want to see more large scale restoration projects like this happen. And if we don't try to help as many people affected by these things as possible, at least the ones that are open to change, then they're not going to keep happening. It's just the way it is, you know. I mean, we already see, like, on a bigger scale, you know, blowback from people within coal and logging and that kind of thing. And I don't think as a movement, the environmental movement did enough to help those people as change happened. And with those ones, those are huge, like, very expensive issues. Here's a really easy one. You have this group of people who is already on your side, and also is helping you create the political will to make these things happen. And it's such a, you know, we're talking about less than 1% of the total project, to put accesses in. It's such a no brainer. And it just, to come in and hurt people economically and, you know, lifestyle for such a, you know, tiny bit of savings just makes no sense to me.
I think your point about
the long term is really impressive. Like, it's a great point. This is this huge project with four dams, and in the future it could be one where we look at it and say, look at the incredible
win for everybody.
It's a win for everybody. Like, we look at it and people are using the whole river, and there's, you know, fish are coming back, and, you know, it's improved the local economy and all of those kinds of things. And that's what it could be. And it really runs the risk of, you know, opening up some really cool stuff that nobody goes and uses, you know, that doesn't make a positive impact for the local communities, which, you know, we want the river to be healthy, but it also, people that live around it are also more likely to help keep it that way in the long run.
Can I ask some super basic questions? Because I haven't followed this project at all. If the dams don't store water, what were they doing?
That's a great one. And that's one that I think a lot of people don't realize. So the water storage for the Klamath happens in a number of spots. The biggest water storage in the Klamath is actually natural. It's a big, huge volcanic drainage. And so even pre all the dams on it, you know, it was a river that routinely would have good flows all the way through the summer. The next biggest part of storage on the Klamath is Klamath Lake, which is natural, but there's also a dam on it, which keeps it at certain levels. And so that's where most of the storage occurs. And then there's one more reservoir down lower called Keno. Keno Dam. It will not be removed. And it, what it does is levels out flows from water coming back in from farmers. The dams that are there, they're solely there to either create more drop to make more electricity or to flatten out flows that are peaking to make electricity. So, you know, the higher the water comes from into a generator, the more power you can make. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, JC Boyle Dam is basically not very high at all. It brings the water up just a little bit, enough to have storage for about 3 days of peaking flows. And they take the water off the top and it goes in a flume, like, pretty flat for a long ways. By the time they drop back down the river's way, way, way down. So you have about a 6-mile stretch of river that's almost completely dry right now, and it drops all that water down the side of the hill in these pipes into the generators to make electricity. So that's one part. And then Copco, the other ones also make electricity, but they're either there to, like I said, smooth out the flows so you don't have peaking flow all the way down to the ocean, or to do a similar sort of thing. They do it in different ways at each dam, but basically it's trying to create more head, is what they call it, to make more power.
These are all about power. These four dams are all about power.
Yeah, they're all about power. They're, you know, you hear a lot about flood control, and I don't know the exact science behind it. I do know that the odds of having floods in this section are really, it just doesn't have any major tributaries coming in that would cause that. And once again, you're looking at, like, super porous volcanic soil. So, okay.
And then do you know what, when the dams come out, is there, like, going to be a whitewater haven down there? Like, whitewater wise, what are we looking at? Do we know there's good runs?
Yes. So I'm going to go from the bottom up. So from the California side to the Oregon side. So right now, the big whitewater run is the Upper Klamath. There really is very few summer runs like it on the West Coast. Just big water, class 4+. At the bottom, near the last dam, it's actually between two of the dams. It's a stretch that's been dewatered, so it's one of those stretches where they're currently putting water into a big canal or pipe or flume in different spots to create more drop and make electricity. There's about a 5-mile stretch called Ward's Canyon, or that's what we've called it lately. And Ward's Canyon, I didn't even know it was there until 2 years ago. It's basically this big area, piece of land that's owned by Pacific Power. You're not allowed to go into it for the most part unless you hike across this crazy volcanic like lava flow. And it is a like full-on columnar basalt slot canyon, you know, kind of in like the Bruno or Middle Oahe style. And in it is class 3 to 4+ whitewater, mostly class 4. And that stretch they did test flows on it when they first studied dam removal back in 2003, I believe, 2005, I can't remember the exact year. And it looks to be, we're fighting for test flows again right now, but it looks like at the normal summer flows at around 1,000 CFS, it's going to offer amazing class 4 whitewater. And I think that section will become more popular, once again, if we have access, than even the Upper Klamath is now, because you can have kayakers from Ashland and Wairika and Shasta like come and lap it 2 or 3 times in the afternoon after work, which is something that we just don't have right now. So that's one of the runs. Below it, there's a fun class 2-3 run, which is currently under Iron Gate. And some of these runs that we're kind of guessing on, Bill Cross, who was one of the main writers of Western Whitewater, he did a lot of research and looking at like old photos and then looking at the drop and the geology to kind of guess on some of these spots under the reservoir. Yep.
Because there's no way to know what's really under the reservoir.
There's no way to know, but you have a pretty, I mean, there's a lot of historic accounts, and we've gotten pretty good at you know, telling what a river is going to do with a mix of geology, flow, and drop. And we knew all those things.
Yeah. And there are historic photos that, I think Bill or Pete and Bill found that show like looking into Ward's Canyon before the dams and looking at Moonshine Falls before the dams, you know, old black and white photos. So there's a pretty good idea of what the canyon would look like. Of course, you know, it's going to be altered to some degree because it's been under a reservoir for so many years. So it'll take a while for it to be fully restored to what it looked like before, but they kind of have a pretty good idea. It looks really incredible. And then the canyon
there's a rapid called Moonshine Falls.
There is. Yeah.
Awesome.
So the two main whitewater runs post dam. So one is the Ward's Canyon. The other one is either we can call it Big Bend or the Bypass Reach. Those reaches, we know exactly what we have because they're just bypass reaches, meaning we can see them and water has been put down them in test flows before. It's not like they've been under a reservoir. There's other runs that are under the reservoir that were more guesswork, but I would still say that's like super educated guesswork. But the two main whitewater runs are, I mean, you can see them. They're just dry most of the time.
Mm-hmm. I have a whole aside I want to go on to. I'm sorry to take us off tangent. Who's going to name the rapids?
That's a good question. That we like just kind of randomly pick names, but we've been like super open. Not names the rapids, even names of the runs. But yeah. we would love to find we picked historic names, but I think like especially Ward's Canyon has had a really important place in the history of a bunch of different tribes, and I think there's better names than Ward's Canyon for sure.
Yeah,
on the way you answer that, it sounds like you are.
we haven't named any rapids, but we've definitely named the stretches. So
yeah.
I mean, there's already some loose names to the bypass reach or Ward's or Big Bend, the run above the Upper Klamath, the current Upper Klamath run. That run gets, you know, once or twice every 2 years gets significant flows, and a lot of people go and run it. And so I'm sure, like, you know, this sidecast slide, I'm sure some of those already have names for that one little section. So
I just want to suggest Zach's Falls.
God.
Oh, jeez.
Just wanted.
Well, I guess you'll have to get down there next. You'll have to run it.
Just a suggestion. it's available for use if you guys want to use it.
And something that I thought was interesting that was brought up at the tour there is someone made the comment that if there was a flat spot that you found along the river, more than likely indigenous people lived there or stayed there for some sort of period of time. There was just so many groups of original people that enjoyed this area on the Klamath River. So I thought that was pretty incredible. You don't necessarily look at a canyon that is somewhat in a remote area of the state or states and be like, oh, I'm sure lots of people have been here before, but I guess there has been. So it'd be really interesting to hear what their names for some of these features were, because I'm sure that they probably had names for them.
Yeah, and because that happening is also has a lot to do with the geology. One, there's not a lot of flat spots. The canyon is relatively young, geologically speaking. And two, it cuts through the corner of the Cascades, but also right up against the Siskiyous. And so there was really no way in the wintertime for people like a long time ago to get from California to Oregon, Oregon back to California, but across the Siskiyous. And so that canyon was a way to get through this, across this mountain range. So it immediately attracted people. And then there is very few flat spots.
True.
So the ones that are there, yeah, were used for the most part, different tribes, and then later on by Gold Rush people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Pete, I'm hearing there's maybe like four-ish. I'm just guessing. It sounds like there's four so different stretches of whitewater in there or places. How many river access points are you guys looking to add?
I should have looked at the map before this. I believe there's three or four brand new ones. Those are all like, and when I say brand new, I mean they're already in disturbed areas. There's already a road right there. Right next to the river. But of the 8 to 10 that you need to access the different stretches, I believe three or four are actually new. And there's only one that is going to be like a more of a difficult one. And that's the one above Wards Canyon, just because it's, right in the middle of Kopko Reservoir, current Kopko Reservoir.
And when you say adding river access, it sounds like there's roads already to these, or do some of these need roads and boat ramps?
Roads to them.
These are just adding boat ramps, like taking a bulldozer, bulldozing some land down, maybe pouring some concrete and a bathroom.
Or even that's gravel.
Yeah, we're not looking for like – so that's a good point. We're not, for the most part, except for a few places where fishing access is a little more tricky because of drift boats. But for whitewater, this is not, I mean, people will do it for sure. This is not going to be a stretch of river where you're going to see a lot of like 4 and 5 day like downriver trips because of the difficulty of the whitewater for a lot of different reasons. So for the most part, we just need gravel. We need parking and either a path or a gravel thing to the river. It's not like something you see in Idaho where there's like, you know, crazy contraptions. We just need to walk a boat to the water.
So this isn't even boat ramps. This is just a place to park and then carry an access to carry boats down to the river. That's all you guys are looking to add.
Yeah. There's two sections. Like I said, there's one access point, the one above Wards Canyon, that will require a little more work because where the river flows, it's dead center in the middle of the old channel is dead center in the middle of Kopko Reservoir. So you're going to have to get a road out to that one. I mean, we're talking about less than a quarter mile. and then there is the put in at JC Boyle, which I suppose that they're like the company that's taking the dams out actually made an access plan for that. And they put in a fancy, you know, boat slide. to be honest with you, it's not needed. It's super cool. But yeah, we're not talking about much.
And it's the company removing the dams that's you're asking to pay for it.
Yes, okay. We're saying so. Basically, when the when, so this gets into the weeds a little bit, but FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the government agency that, you know, decides when dams can be built and when they can be removed and all those kind of things. And when they looked at the option of dam removal the last time, they did a NEPA study, an environmental study. One of the things they said was recreation was one of the main, river recreation was one of the main things that was going to be hurt by dam removal, so that they needed to make sure whoever was taking the dams out, that mitigation happened. Like, they did something about that. And so that's what we consider this is making it for the fact that we're going to lose the Upper Klamath for the most part as a summer run, which is when it's, you know, when most we want to do it. With a couple accesses, we can now access the new sections of the river.
Are you saying that NEPA protected recreation?
It did, yeah. NEPA is a lot of different things. I think better think of NEPA as this, like, I never really get in the weeds, as this thing that stops us from getting permits. I mean, I personally love NEPA. I think it is a really important law, and I think the issue that people have with NEPA is there's not enough agency staff, whatever that agency might be, to go through those processes. But I think, I mean, I personally am not in favor of weakening NEPA in any way.
Pete, can you just, for our listeners, the acronym NEPA?
It's, oh my God, I can't even think of what it stands for.
National Environmental
Policy Act.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, but, I asked you that for sure. No, I thought I wanted you to.
But
say
it's there to protect the. It's a law that's to protect the environment, and you're saying in this case it's being used to protect recreation, which is not the environment.
Yeah, and I don't know. I have to look through the FERC's thing. I mean, they do a lot of stuff that's included with NEPA, and I don't know if that particular recreation part was like exactly put into NEPA, but they call it their NEPA review. But yeah, that's something I probably should like get into more. But there's a bunch of like there's more hoops than just NEPA that you have to go through when building or removing a dam.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And FERC, like the relicensing is actually a tool that American Whitewater uses a lot to ask for improved access or access where there previously has not been. And through NEPA, you can provide comments or suggestions in their draft impact statement. And then eventually those kind of suggestions or comments can be implemented into future planning at a site or for an area. So it is a really valuable tool for providing access to recreation if used in a thoughtful way. It is a very exhausting process and takes a lot of brain power to understand exactly how to best use it, but it's certainly a good tool, especially paired with the Federal Energy Regulatory relicensing process.
Yeah, and they put that in there originally too, with dams and stuff, because dams or a lot of big power projects tend to be on public land or on land that's maybe not like federally public, but state public. And so it was a way to say, hey, this is land that everybody should get access to. So we need to make, you know, these power companies and stuff make sure they supply access. So that like, that's always been a big part, or it has been in modern times, of any sort of big project like this.
So, Pete, I think, you know, you brought up that it was noted that really recreation was going to be one of the things that was most negatively impacted by this. So
whitewater recreation, yeah.
Whitewater recreation, right. So, you know, I'm not sure how to get you to, or how you should give this, but give me a sense of kind of, you know, what is your Upper Klamath? Like, how many people do you run on the Upper Klamath now versus how many will you be able to run in the future based on the season change?
Yeah, so right now, I don't have the people numbers, but this year, the outfitters did a little over $500,000 in direct sales. And then the estimate for, like, money spent in this area was over $2 million. And the interesting thing about the Upper Klamath is it's a destination trip. So it's one of those ones that people come for just like they came to the area because of that river, as opposed to like coming to the area and then deciding to go on a river trip. So it's a pretty solid chunk. Right now, I mean,
and that will mostly go away
almost completely. You're going to have less than 5 to 10% of that.
And, you know, you're fortunate in that your business is pretty diverse in that, you know, you've got other things you do, right?
Yep.
But there's definitely some other outfitters that
don't
have that diversity, and they're going to lose. Yeah, exactly. Like over half, three quarters of their business is going to disappear with this if there's not
Well, it is going to disappear. The question is, are there going to be some other options for them to replace it?
Wait, why is it going away? I mean, the river's still there.
Yeah,
water,
so
water.
Yep. So what's going on? And this is a good thing to say too about the dam removal stuff. So right now, we during the summertime, one of the reasons the Upper Klamath is so amazing, besides its geology, is we get peaking power. So they during the night, the river flow in this stretch of river is very low, and then during the day, they crank it up to make electricity for California. And so we're running on that bubble of water that they put down every day. So even in August, when every other river is completely like dry, we're hammering down at like, you know, close to 2000 CFS. And so that peaking power will go away. The same amount of water is going to be in the river that there is now post dams. That's not changing. It's just not going to come down in those peaking pulses.
So they're removing a dam. And what that means is the flow is on average is going to be less, which is too low to run the Upper Klamath commercially.
The flow will be the same, but it won't be peaking. So, right. So the flow is going to be between 800 and 1,000 CFS through that stretch post dam removal, and that on that particular stretch of river, that's not a really a great flow to run it on. Right now, when we're in the middle of summer, the flow will be at night, say 200 CFS, and during the day, 2,000 CFS.
But during the day, when you go rafting, it's going to be half the flow now.
Yep.
After the dam, half the flow, and it's not a good level to run the river at.
It's not.
But you're saying the other sections of the river are maybe more channelized, and they will be runnable.
Exactly, especially Wards Canyon. It's a different geology. It's just a different section. Yep.
How does this affect the Lower Klamath?
I won't affect it. Well, from a water flow thing, it won't affect it at all. The water ideally will be cleaner. That's for sure.
Water quality should be a lot better.
Water quality, yeah. But it won't. That's what a lot of people don't. You know, we've been like really careful with comments. Like, I try not to ever comment on social media, but we've forced to a little bit on this. Is people are like, oh, there's not gonna be any more water in the river. That's not true. That these dams do not store water more than a couple days, and the flow coming into the river and coming into the Upper Klamath section of the river and exiting into the Lower Klamath now will be the same post dam.
And that's because let me ask this question really quick. Because the peak flow is going to catch up with the non-peak flow.
No, because
I don't understand, because it's like a 2000 CFS peak flow comes out.
Right.
So the Lower Klamath be 2000 CFS, it'll only be 1000 CFS now.
Well, remember there's four dams. So it's making that peaking flow is the upper dam.
That makes sense.
And then it flows into Copco. Then mellows out the peaking flow. Then they peak again into Iron Gate, and Iron Gate mellows out the peaking flow, and then they release from Iron Gate. So you can think of the two main reservoirs, Iron Gate Reservoir, Copco, are solely there to flatten out the peaking flow so a normal flow of water comes out of the stretch.
I get it. Yeah. So the Lower Klamath will be the same.
Yep, but better water quality.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So Pete, there was a great article in Statesman Journal out of Salem, Zach Yernis wrote about this, I don't know, last week or something. And if I remember right, he put an email address in there for these folks who are doing this. I know I sent an email to them,
as I tend to do.
But what else, what can people do to sort of help the cause here?
Yeah, I think making comments to KRC, like constructive comments, is great. You know, just saying that recreation is important. And then also, honestly, to talk to a big part of this is, to be quite honest, the states may have to step in to fix this. And if you're in California, talking to your senators and governor, and if you're in Oregon, talking to your senators and governor, just reaching out to them. It's amazing what a few, like, once again, you know, well thought out letters will, emails will do. And one thing too, I would say about this is, right now, the Upper Klamath is mostly done by outfitters. And the reason for that is it's a massive shuttle, and it's a difficult river to scout. And so it's big. And so it's hard for the general public to get on there without an outfitter. I think it's something like 95% of the use is outfitted. But these new stretches of river are not going to be like that. Like, this isn't just for outfitters. It's for all boaters.
I have one more question. Can we use Marine Board funds to do this?
I know that.
If it's in Oregon, you can apply for it.
Yeah. So from our standpoint, and the only way, as you know, very small businesses in this like massive political project, our main push has just been the company that's taking it out, KRC. You guys, this is your thing. You got to deal with this, figure it out. But we are also searching for ideas, and I've heard from the state that that is a possibility, but I have no idea.
Well, Pete, thanks for coming and telling us about this. Like I said, I got that email out of Zach's newspaper piece, and I emailed him, and I heard back from him. Like, they read it, or yep. At least, you know, they claim mm-hmm. they did. So if you're listening to this, find that article from Zach and send an email to these folks.
We'll put a link on the website to that article and a link to the email so you can email them directly.
You guys have a website too?
The website.
Yeah.
River
Talk
Podcast.
We even have a Facebook now. Yeah.
We do?
So legit.
Yeah.
We have a Facebook.
I thought I saw that the other day.
We have a Facebook.
Awesome. It's about time.
Pete, one of the things we like to do as we sort of wind down the podcast is we have a section we get called Gear of the Week. And we talk about some piece of gear that we love, typically river related, although not always. We'd love to hear your gear of the week, but I'll give you a minute to think about it.
I got it.
Oh, you got
I'll
it.
I'll do mine first. Yeah. Four-legged Alps chairs.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, God.
It's America outdoor season. That's why this is.
Four-legged Alps chairs. Beat that, Pete.
Please say three-legged outdoor.
I love our three-legged chairs. No. But we have this thing now that we're going to have in our base camps and the smaller version that we're going to take down on a lot of our trips. It's the Uni pizza oven. It's a portable pizza oven that makes pizza in like 60 seconds. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever used. I had a pizza party on Saturday. It was awesome.
Uni, like UNI?
OONI.
I'm looking this up right now. This sounds amazing.
It's amazing.
Ridiculous. 60 seconds per pizza? That doesn't sound safe.
Oh, it's 900 degrees. Yeah. It's hot.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to take this on river trips or it's going to be your base camps?
Both.
This doesn't seem safe.
Yeah, dude. 9:32 in 10 minutes.
Don't you guys use a blaster, Zach? That is literally a jet engine pointed straight up.
I'm into this.
Good point.
This looks amazing. Very cool. Let's see. Priscilla, do you have gear of the week?
Sure. So my gear of the week, or I guess my hopeful gear of the week, is getting some Polar Tech layers. I have a lot of issues with like hiking and then paddling when it's colder. So I'll hike and I sweat a lot and then I freeze when I'm paddling. So I'm pretty excited about a newish Polar Tech fabric. And I can't remember the exact name of it, but basically it is lightweight, but warm like wool would be. It's like a synthetic blend with wool, so it keeps you warm, but it also wicks away like perspiration so that you're not just sitting in damp clothes or overheating when you're hiking. So I'm gonna buy a few of those layers very soon here and test them out, and I'm hoping that I finally have some layers that that last me through winter and cold season.
Have you heard the new theory that and it's getting more and more popular that like a lot of high altitude climbers are going by it, is that a lot of our clothes have become too good at wicking. And so your body sweats and it body feels the sweat. So it's like, all right, I've already sweat. I don't have to sweat more, but our clothes have gotten so good at wicking away that your body doesn't realize that it's been sweating. So it just keeps sweating.
Oh, really? Maybe that's one of the issues I've been having.
A lot of climbers are going to slightly less wicking.
Huh. Yep. That's interesting. Yeah, I was really interested in this one. And again, I can't find the specific name of it, but it's like their blend with wool and synthetic. Because I feel like wool, when I'm hiking around in thin wool, I have less of an issue with it. But then the fabric wears out so quickly just because it's a natural fiber. It doesn't last as long for me. But then, of course, with the kind of the polypropylene type fabrics that are really good at wicking, they stay stinky forever. So I guess that's the other part of it. But I'm sure there's a solution out there. I just haven't spent enough money to find it yet.
All right. I'm interested in that sweat ick, your the fabric is too good thing. I'm not looking at
that. Yeah, that's very interesting.
My gear of the week is Goodr sunglasses.
Hell so, yeah.
Goodr. Goodr.com. They're $25 polarized sunglasses. Pairs. Yeah, I've got two that showed up today. So they're, you know, I'm a huge sunglass person. I wear sunglasses when it's like cloudy outside. Like I always have sunglasses and I always have polarized sunglasses. I'm a big believer in spend money on sunglasses because good optics are important. And Goodr sunglasses, like, you know, maybe they're not your top shelf quality optics, but they're pretty damn close for a quarter of the price or less than quarter of the price, like an eighth of the price. I love them. They've been good, durable. I bike in them. Like, wow. You know, they breathe pretty well.
Super colorful too.
Super colorful. And like the names. So I'm looking through the list of names right here. They name like all the different color combinations. One of them's a ginger soul. One of them's whiskey shots with Satan. sunbathing with wizards. Donkey goggles. Swedish meatball hangover. So, you know. You get to sport some things that look pretty good, very colorful, and have fun names, all for $25. So big believer in the Goodr sunglasses. And I think they were originally created by a bunch of runners. So they actually breathe really well. Like I was biking in them yesterday and sweating pretty good and they didn't fog up on me or anything. Like been pretty impressive. So solid $25 spend. I think that's everything for this week. Pete, thanks for joining us, telling us about the plan.
Yeah.
Everybody thanks, go Pete. To our website, get that link, email these folks, tell them we need some boat ramps on the Klamath for when the dams come out. And go out, get paddling, and come back and listen to us again on your next trip to the river.
Yeah.
Like us and follow us and do all the things that, you know, you're supposed to do with podcasts.
Wait, so we really have a Facebook page. How do we find it?
Just River Talk Podcast.
On Facebook.
Yeah.
All right. I'll put a link.
I haven't really invited any. I'll make you guys admins.
I'm good.
I'm too late, actually.
Too late. I have enough Facebook pages, too. You're not getting out of it.
Hey, are we done, Eric? Is that your awkward ending, or do you want to do a real awkward ending?
Let's end it right here on this. This is going to blow me into a new state of mind. I'm on Chattahoochee on the Rio Grande, the Allegheny and the Cumberland.